everyone, and welcome to the IBM Why Did the DB2Z Optimizer Choose That Access Path conference call. Today's call is being recorded, and to get us started today, I'm pleased to turn the floor over to Mr. Terry Purcell. Mr. Purcell, you may begin, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, good evening, depending on where you are in the world. My name is Terry Purcell. I'm a senior software engineer with DB2 Optimizer development in the IBM Silicon Valley Lab. Hopefully you have the presentation in front of you. This is focusing on DB2 version 8. On slide 2, I have the agenda, an introduction covering then data skew, correlation, range predicate accuracy, and then finally conclusion. Obviously, I will cover each more of those topics in far more detail. On slide 3, the goal of this presentation, when the optimizer makes a poor access path choice, so you have an SQL statement that is performing poorly, what I want to do is demonstrate to you how DB2 for ZOS version 8 makes it easier to identify what went wrong, why did the optimizer choose that poor access path, and resolve the problem with the right solution. And I term the right solution as we'll identify through the examples. You won't see me using things like tricks or hints and so forth. I will try and resolve the problem the preferred way with resolving why the optimizer actually chose the wrong access path. So to reach that goal, how to determine why the optimizer may choose a poor access path, we're going to use some simple query examples. We're going to look through the DB2 ZOS optimizer estimates, show how it estimates the number of qualified rows per object, compare this to the actual qualified rows per object. Previously, I think many customers have identified that the optimizer is very much a black box. What I would like to do is show you that the fundamentals behind the optimizer are actually quite logical and not too difficult to understand. So hopefully I achieve that at the end of this conference call. I'm going to cover the three most common reasons that we see the optimizer choosing a poor access path choice. Obviously, I can't cover every situation that you may encounter, but if I give you three of the most common ones, then hopefully that will help you in your query performance challenges. Those three common reasons are data skew, correlation, and range predicates with host variables or parameter markers. On slide 5, to cover some of the keywords that we'll use, the first one being filter factor. Basically, the optimizer applies a filter factor to each where clause predicate. It's a number between 0 and 1. It's similar to a percentage, being 0 being 0% and 1 being 100%. So a filter factor of 0.25 means we estimate that 25% of the rows are estimated to qualify based on that where clause predicate. So 0.75 is 75% of the rows, 0.9, 90% of the rows, etc. We calculate this using the available statistics such as column cardinality, such as gender. You might have two values for gender. You might have a million values for account number. That is column cardinality. High two key and low two key, used for range predicate calculation in general. Frequency statistics are stored in frequency F in the SysIBM SysColdist table. On slide 6, combining the filter factors. Once we assign the individual filter factors, if you have multiple where clause predicates, then we must combine the individual filter factors. If they're ANDed together, so there's ANDs between the where clause predicates, then we multiply the filter factors together. If there are OR predicates, then the filter factors are added together. And the available statistics determine the degree of multiplication. And we will get back to that when we look at correlation. So on slide 7, the accuracy of individual filter factors and how to combine them is important for index matching, total index filtering, and total table level filtering. The examples we'll cover today are focused on simple single table queries where the optimizer may be choosing the wrong index. But basically, the more indexes you have, or the more tables you have in the query, so the more objects involved, the more important it is for the optimizer to be able to distinguish between the objects. So this is about a competition. For each table, what is the best index for each of the, when you have multiple tables in the query, what is the ultimate table join sequence? So the individual filter factors and how we combine them, if you have multiple filter factors, multiple where clause predicates for each index, which index is the best? And we'll go through some examples of that. So for each object, the goal is to accurately assign the individual predicate filter factors and then to correctly combine the individual filter factors. On slide 8 is just a simple example of using the free Visual Explain tool. That's the version 8 Visual Explain tool, which does work in DB2 version 7, but does not provide the extensive detail that we're going to see throughout this presentation. So as you see, the query graph on the right-hand side, we're choosing an index scan, then fetch through to the customers table. If you highlight one of those nodes, and I'm highlighting the index scan node on this slide, on the left-hand side you will see the detail show up, such as the input reads, the number of index leaf pages. That level of detail has been available to you throughout version 7 and prior releases. What you haven't had before is the additional information, such as now we're showing you the predicate filter factors, what the optimizer is estimating, showing you, in this case, that it's a matching predicate. We also show you whether it's index screening, stage 1 or stage 2. So we show you there how many leaf pages we estimate are going to qualify, or how many we're going to scan, how many RIDs will qualify from that index, and so forth. On slide 9, we look at the reports that are provided through the Visual Explain tool. From the Toon SQL screen, if you choose the Report tab and click on Generate Report, there are significant options there to include or exclude many options. But if you generate the report, you will see a query summary, a table summary, and a predicate summary. We're going to focus on the predicate summaries and the table summaries. Basically, where the prior screen, slide 8, showed you that if you click on an individual node, you can see the individual detail for that index scan or for that fetch node or for that table. When you have a multi-table query, and that can be cumbersome to go through and click through each of the nodes. The predicate summary and the table summary provide that information. Predicate summary provides you all of the filter factors for all the where clause predicates. The table summary provides you the estimates for all the tables in the query. So it puts it in one place rather than you having to click through each of the nodes in the graph. So we'll refer to the predicate and table summaries throughout some of the examples. Okay, now to the first example on data skew. On slide 11, an explanation of data skew. Data skew describes a situation where data is not uniformly distributed. A simple example here is those status columns that we often see in tables. You might have two values of yes and no, but it's never 50% yes and 50% no. It's often 95% yes and 5% no, or even worse, 99% yes and 5% no. Now, the data can be point skewed, so it can be skewed on that single value, or it can be skewed over a range. For example, over a range, you might have more sales throughout the period of between the first 2 weeks or first 3 weeks of December than you might have in the first 3 weeks of March. So that would be skewed over a range of values. You have significantly more records or more sales over that range of data compared to a different range of data. We're going to focus on point skewing in this simple example. So on slide 12, you'll see a simple example where the user has brought to the DBA's attention a query that's performing poorly. We have a simple WHERE clause of four WHERE clause predicates, single table access, the access path being chosen from the visual explain graph here is via index cust ix2. Now, when you look at the explain output or you look at the visual explain graph here, there's nothing necessarily that is popping out to be a significant problem. We're not doing a table space scan of the table. We're not using list prefetch where maybe you don't want list prefetch being chosen. We're not choosing multi-index access where that is not the preferred access method. It's quite a simple single index access against this table. So there's nothing identifying right now where there is an obvious problem with this query. So on slide 13, when I'm faced with a query problem like this, I go through this type of approach to identify what the reality is and why then the optimizer is not choosing the right access path. So you want to start by determining where the problem is. Now to do that, I run a count against that query, against the table, to figure out, well, what's the reality? How many rows are going to qualify from this query? Now you need the actual data values, because if you noticed on slide 12, this query had post variables or parameter markers. Now you need the actual data values to run the account of the query. You can't execute it with just the parameter markers or post variables. You need the data values. If you want to know what data values to use, generally you want to use data values that perform poorly. Now you want to see, why is this query performing poorly with these data values? If you use data values that perform well, then it's going to be very difficult for you to figure out why there's a query performance problem, because the data values you used did not have a problem. So I've got these four data values. The count returns 811 rows qualifying from this query. On slide 14, then what I want to do is identify what are the available choices to the optimizer. Now, if this is a multi-table join, then there's many join sequences for the optimizer to consider. But this is only a single table query. Now, within each table, whether it's a single table or multi-table query, there may be many indexes that are candidates. So what I do is break apart the query per object to see what is the reality of the number of qualifying rows if the optimizer choose index A versus index B, etc. So as I said, this example is a single table query. Now what are the available indexes? And I want to match them to this query. So on slide 15, I find that there's two available indexes that have columns that match the WHERE clause predicate. We have index cust ix2 that is available for match calls 2 on country and city, or I have index cust ix3, which could match on country, status, and gender. And you may recall from the prior slides that the optimizer is choosing cust ix2. So as I mentioned, I want to break apart the query and run a count per object. So on slide 16, you'll see that the count of rows qualified by cust ix2 is 147,000 rows qualifying when I specify country of USA and city of New York. And that's the current index choice by the optimizer. The count from qualified rows of cust ix3 of country USA, gender F, and status N is 1,121. So it's clear to you and I as we're looking at this slide that definitely CUST iX3 is the better choice for the optimizer. So while this is a significantly better choice, we must ask the question, why is the optimizer chosen the wrong index in this case? On slide 17, I'm going to break down the query even further to each individual where clause predicate. The reason to do that is because how the optimizer calculates its estimates per object, it first has to assign the filter factors for each where clause predicate and then combine them together. So while it's interesting to look at the two where clause predicates for CUST iX2 or the three where clause predicates for CUST iX3 in combination, until we see how the individual where clause predicates were assigned, it's difficult for us to figure out whether the optimizer has assigned those where clause predicates the correct filter factors. So the counts you'll see, where country equals USA, 192,000. As you'll see, or as you may have seen in some of the prior slides, there is actually 192,960 rows in the table. So where country equals USA does not provide any filtering. Where city equals New York, that predicate qualifies 147,000 rows. Gender equals female, 24,000. Status equal no, 9,000. So that is the reality. That's how many rows qualify from this table. On slide 18, we look at the optimizer's estimates from the predicate summary report, which I described in the introduction, how to find the report. You can see here that all of the four where clause predicates, country, city, gender, and status, you'll see that there is a left-hand side column cardinality, the predicate type is an equal, and the filter factor on the right-hand side. So a question, how has the optimizer arrived at these filter factors? So there is only one country value. So when you say where country equals a certain value, we know that you're looking for one value. There is only one value, so we assume that you're looking for 100% of the data from that where clause predicate. The city column has 26 possible values, and the filter factor is 0.0385. How did the optimizer figure that out? Well, you're looking for 1 out of 26 values. 1 divided by 26 is 0.03846. And you'll see the filter factor there is rounded up as 0.0385. So that is how the optimizer has figured out that filter factor. You're looking for one value out of a possible 26. For gender, there are three possible values. The three possible values, I haven't added a new gender. There is actually male, female, or unknown in this case, so null. You're looking for one value out of a possible three. 1 over 3 is 0.3333. For status, filter factor is 0.5. There are two possible values for status. We're looking for one of them, so the optimizer assumes one out of the two, 0.5 is the filter factor. So what you can see here is that the optimizer is assuming that the data is evenly distributed, the simple example being status. There are two possible statuses. You're looking for one of them. We assume they're 50% one value and 50% the other value. Now, on slide 19, I'm going to show you how the optimizer has figured out the estimate to calculate how many rows qualify from the index that it chose. So from the visual explain object detail, the index scan detail, you'll see that the input reads is 192,000. The number of leaf pages is 1,723. You look at the matching predicates, the filter factors, 1 for country and 0.0385 for city. The optimizer assumes that we're going to look at 67 leaf pages. It assumes that 7,422 rows are going to qualify from that index. So how did it figure out these values? Well, the calculations are there quite simply on the bottom of this slide. There's 192,960 rows in the table. You multiply it by those two filter factors. Multiply by 1 over 1, which is 1, multiply by 1 over 26, and we get 7,421.54. So rounded up, that is 7,422. That's how the optimizer has figured out how many rows qualify from that index. So the obvious point there, as you'll see in, at the bottom of the slide, if these filter factors are wrong, then the estimate will be wrong. If the filter factor is truly not 1 over 1 or the filter factor is not truly 1 over 26, then the reality will differ from what the optimizer will estimate. So on slide 20, you'll see that I have a table of that compares the actual filter factor to the optimizer filter factor. It's very easy to calculate the actual filter factors or what the reality is. You'll see for each where clause predicate, I've listed in the second column the count that came back from those where clause, those counts that I executed earlier. The table cardinality is 192,960. So if you take the count and you divide it by the table cardinality, in then the fourth column, you'll see the actual filter factor of what the reality is for these where clause predicates. So the good news is country equals USA. When we compare the actual filter factor in the fourth column to the optimizer's filter factor in the fifth column, we got the first one correct. The second one, city equals New York. The reality is that 0.76 or 76% of the rows qualify from that where clause predicate. The optimizer thinks 0.0385 or 3.85% of the table qualifies. Okay, so how did the optimizer get that so wrong? Well, given that the optimizer assumes that there are 26 values and you're looking for one of them, and they're evenly distributed, I think we've shown that City of New York being itself 76% of the data, maybe we have more rows for New York than we do for the other 25 values of city. You'll see also that gender of female, also the optimizer's filter factor is 0.33, the actual for this one is 0.125, and also status, the actual is 0.05 or 5%, the optimizer assumes 50%. So one out of four is not too good as far as the optimizer getting the estimates correct. So on slide 21, I want to show you, and also on slide 22, how you can run some simple counts to show whether your columns are unevenly distributed or not. So against the customers table, select city, comma, count, group by city, order by the count descending or column 2 descending, and you'll see from the output there that 147,000 rows qualify for New York, 21,000 for Chicago, 7,900 for Atlanta, and so forth. So when I calculate what that means from a percentage perspective, 76% of the rows qualify for New York, 11% for Chicago, 4% for Atlanta, and so forth. So you can see there that it's quite obvious that the data is not evenly distributed. On slide 22, we do the same for status and gender. And you'll see there that status of yes is 95% of the data, and status of no is 5% of the data. Gender, male is 70%, null is 17.5%, and female is 12.5%. So I have in bold red there, if you don't provide that data skew information to the optimizer, how can it know that status is not 50% yes and 50% no? How does it know that it's 95% yes and 5% no? Remember, if you don't provide those statistics to the optimizer, How can it know that the data is not evenly distributed? Slide 23 shows you how in version 8 we make it a lot simpler to collect this non-uniform distribution statistic information, or skew statistics. In version 7 or in version 8, by default, RunStats will collect the top 10 most frequently occurring values on each leading index column. And so we're collecting those statistics for you on the leading index columns by default. But in version 7, it's a little more difficult to collect these statistics on the non-leading index column. But in version 8, quite simply, you can collect on nearly any column except for things like long varchar and lobs and so forth. You specify the col group keyword, and here I have col group status freak val count 10. I'm collecting the top 10 most frequently occurring values for status. Now there are only two values for status. RunStats will obviously only be able to collect two, so specifying count 10 is overkill, but it's not going to hurt RunStats. So we're collecting the frequency for the single columns of status, city, and gender. On slide 24, now we have the new statistics. But the access path hasn't actually changed. We're still choosing the CUST-IX2 index. Now, why is that? If you look at the WHERE clause predicate, I still have WHERE country equals host variable or parameter marker, city equals host variable or parameter marker, and so forth. On slide 24, this explains it. Host variables or parameter markers cannot exploit frequency statistics. Even though we have statistics that show that status of yes is 95% and status of no is 5%, when you come in with a host variable or parameter marker, we don't know whether you're going to put in there yes or no. So we just hedge our bets and say, okay, we're back to using default, which is uniform distribution estimate. There is one exception, though. Gender equals host variable or gender equals parameter marker can never be null. To specify, to check for null in the WHERE clause, you specify where gender is null. So given that we've collected frequency statistics on the gender column, you'll see in the predicate summary there that there is no longer a filter factor of 0.33333. Now, the reason is that the optimizer has taken into consideration that we're going to exclude nulls from that estimate. So there are 33,722 nulls. The filter factor will therefore exclude the nulls, so we'll take away those 33,000 from the original number of rows in the table. And now we're only looking for two possible values because we're excluding the null. So we're looking for one half of 192,960 minus the 33,000. And then we get a filter factor of 0.412. But obviously that wasn't enough to divert the optimizer to choose the preferred index. On slide 26, you'll see what the access path is when I use the actual literal value. So I have the new statistics, and I've provided the literal values of the country, city, gender, and status in the WHERE clause. I've either used the reopt always bind parameter, or reopt vars, as it's previously been known, or I've hard-coded the literal. Now the optimizer chooses the preferred index. On slide 27, you'll see the new predicate summary report. And in this case, the optimizer's filter factors compared to my actual filter factors that I calculated earlier, they all match perfectly. Now, the goal is not always to get 100% perfection. And we just need to be in the ballpark. Thinking city qualifies 3% when it really qualifies 76% is going to potentially cause a different access path to it. But we don't have to perfectly estimate 76%. getting closer to 50, 60, 70% is going to get us in a better range and more likely to choose the correct access path. So I have access path filter factor perfection here because the frequency statistics I've collected, the optimizer uses those and does not bother doing any calculations. Now, the challenge with this query, as you'll see on slide 28, was that this is a query where the index on city, so country and city, it was a poor choice for New York. But given the data skew for city, it's going to be a good choice maybe for those other columns, so those other column values such as city of Atlanta, Jacksonville, Las Vegas, or that famous city, Paris, Illinois, where 96 rows qualify in this table. Now, the other index that included status and gender may be a good choice for gender of female and status of no, but it's probably a poor choice if you're looking for status of yes and gender of male. So the different data values in this case may call for a different index choice. So that's difficult for the optimizer. Firstly, if you don't provide the literal values, and also if there's an access path out there, there are different access paths out there that are preferred depending on what the data values you specify. So we'll get to some conclusions in a minute. Firstly, I just want to go through another feature of the Visual Explain tool. So on slide 29, at this point, we've already identified why the optimizer was choosing the wrong access path choice. It was because the data was skewed and the optimizer had no knowledge of that. Firstly, we didn't have the data skew statistics, and secondly, we were using host variables and the optimizer was not able to use that skew information. The Visual Explain tool has an Analyze button from the Toon SQL screen. So you'll see I have the SQL in the Toon SQL screen on slide 29. If I click on that Analyze button, on slide 30, what you'll see is some run stats recommendations. Basically, the Analyze button will fire off the Statistics Advisor tool, which again is free in the Visual Explain tool in version 8. And this only works in version 8, not in version 7. The Statistics Advisor tool here has recommended that we collect these run stats. You'll notice the call group status, freak val count of 1, call group city, and call group gender frequencies count of 10. So basically, these are the same frequencies that we had identified throughout this presentation that were needed for the optimizer to correctly decipher which index was the best. So Statistics Advisor is doing this analysis for you. On slide 31, Statistics Advisor also gives you explanation of the recommendations that it provided. So there's an explanation tab there. It tells you why we recommended frequency statistics on gender and also on status. Now, this Statistics Advisor tool is using the optimizer, DB2 optimizer team's knowledge about generally what we see as the reason why these statistics should be collected. Running the counts, as I've done throughout this presentation, gives you proof. Statistics Advisor just says, I believe this column is skewed. And the reason I believe it's skewed is because experience tells us that low cardinality columns like gender and status are often skewed. But Statistics Advisor does not prove that they are skewed, so it may actually recommend statistics that may not be necessary. The only harm, of course, is the cost in run stats in running those statistics. So we're not doing away with the requirement for the DBAs or application developers to analyze, as I have done in this presentation, simply providing them tools to sometimes shortcut. And you can use the counts and so forth to determine whether to validate the recommendations from Statistics Advisor. On slide 32, you'll also see that statistics advisor has recommended that we use reopt-vars or reopt-ones as bind options. And the reason given is because the predicates, following predicates may contain host variables, parameter markers, or special registers. So it's showing you that, from the original query, that the optimizer is potentially going to have a problem with these where clause predicates if they're skewed. So some conclusions for data skew on slide 33. When column values are unevenly distributed, the optimizer is not aware unless you collect the frequency statistics. As I mentioned earlier, how can the optimizer know that status is 95% yes and 5% no if you don't provide that statistic? Again, without the literal values, either from reopt vars, reopt always, or reopt once, then the optimizer will not know what value you're going for. So again, the optimizer will not know whether the value you're looking for is skewed or not. The exception being null frequencies, as I explained earlier. Now, on slide 34, there's some possible recommendations for this data skew challenge for the optimizer. Recommendation number one. Now, these recommendations do not have to be taken in combination. Option one is reopt always or reopt vars would resolve this problem for this query. Can you accept the bind prepare overhead that this adds to executing it? Every time the query executes, we'll reevaluate the access path. Maybe you can, maybe you cannot accept that overhead. I guess it depends on what the performance regression is going to be if the optimizer is fixed to choose one access path, and sometimes that access path is a disaster. Maybe the overhead of reopt always is acceptable to avoid that disaster. Option number two is, had I created an index that supported all of the combinations and I hadn't given the optimizer a choice between CUST-IX2 index and CUST-IX3 index, then if there was a single index, then the choices become a lot simpler for the optimizer. So one index that supported all the where clause predicates would have been a solution that worked well always for this query, regardless of the data values. Some other recommendations, number three, if search is always for the same status value, hard code the literal in the SQL. If you're always looking for status equals yes, don't put that in a working storage variable, to use a COBOL term, and then use that working storage variable in the where clause predicate. The optimizer has no knowledge that you're always looking for the same value. So hard code the literal in the SQL if you're always looking for the same column value. But ensure that you collect the frequency statistics so the optimizer has that information as well. Recommendation number four, don't index columns that are skewed and the search is by a high frequency value. Again, if you're always looking for status equals yes, which is 95% of the data, don't put that in an index, especially if it's an index that the optimizer, which may sway the optimizer to choose that index, and it's going to be a poor choice. Option number five, you can separate the SQLs for skewed cases. So then have application code that says, if I'm looking for status yes, then code this SQL. If I'm looking for status no, then code this SQL, and you could hard code the literal. That is probably one of the least preferred options, but it is another option to resolve this problem. So there's five potential solutions to that data skew problem. Now, on slide 35, the next topic we're going to cover is correlation and the effect of index screening. So the first problem we went through was data skew. Second is going to be correlation. Slide 36 provides you an explanation of what correlation is. Basically, it's when two or more columns are not independent. Some examples, city and state. Every city does not exist in every state. Another example is automobile manufacturer and model. Only Toyota makes a Camry. So once I know that it's a Camry, it adds no value to say, oh, and the manufacturer is Toyota. So in that case, those columns are highly correlated. An example of independence would be state and gender. To my knowledge, males and females occur in each state of the U.S. Now, for correlation, it determines the degree that the optimizer will multiply those predicate filter factors. And the important factor here is that it's applicable to literals, host variables, and parameter markets. So whereas data skew required the literal values, that was because that's how we apply the individual filter factors. Correlation is how we multiply the filter factors. So once the filter factors are applied, regardless of whether they are applied for literal values or host variables or parameter markers, correlation then determines how we multiply those individual where clause predicate filter factors. Slide 37. So here's my customer, my query performance problem. Three where clause predicates. Zip code, city, and state. Again, we have host variables. And the optimizer is choosing the city and state index. So it's matching on city and screening on state. There is a count number as the second column in between. We also have another choice, index cust IX5, which is on zip code and account number. So again, I'll go through the same process as I did in the prior example. So on slide 38, I want to figure out where the problem is. So I take the SQL and I run a count using some where clause predicates that I know perform poorly. In this case, 3,072 rows qualify from those where clause predicates from this table. Same table that we used in the prior example. Now again, as I did in the prior example, what I want to do is break down the query per object. It's a single table query. There's two available indexes that I have for these where clause predicates. I could choose cust IX5 or cust IX4. So matching the query to those indexes. And on slide 40, I'm going to run counts per object. You'll see that the optimizer is currently choosing cust IX4, and based on those where clause predicates, 21,504 rows qualify from that index. The index on zip code, 3,072 rows qualify. So it's clear, again to us, that the optimizer has made a poor choice. On slide 41, we take it the further step, and we run counts per individual where clause predicates. Now remember that number, 21,504, was the number of rows qualified for the CUS IX4 index. You'll see there that where city equals Chicago provides that count. And then state of Illinois qualifies 21,792. What that means is that city alone in this example provides all the filtering. For these two where clause predicates, the state of Illinois provides no further benefit. So in my database, Chicago only exists in the state of Illinois. So once I know the city, it doesn't provide me any value to know the state. Of course, that's not always true. Often cities do occur in multiple states. The third predicate, zip code equals 60607, qualifies 3,072, which actually equals the total table filtering. So what that means is once I know the zip code, there is no benefit to knowing the city and state. That's what those counts are showing me. Now, what is the optimizer seeing? On slide 42, here we get into a little bit more detail than the prior example. So hopefully you've had your cup of coffee. The optimizer index estimate here from the visual explained, again, we start with 192,000 reads. This index has 1,678 leaf pages. We have one matching predicate, city equals whatever, and the filter factor is 3.85%. So we estimate we're going to scan 65 leaf pages. We have one screening predicate, and its filter factor is 0.1111. So there are 9 possible values for state, 26 possible values for city. You'll see the total number of reads that are output from this index. We estimate that 825 rows will qualify from this index. Now, circled down the bottom, you'll see the matching filter factor. So that's how many rows we will scan in the index. Sorry, the filter factor for the matching, how many, the matching filter factor from the index, and the total filter factor from the index as well. So matching filter factor tells us how much of the index we will scan. Total filter factor tells us what then percentage of the rows ultimately qualify from that index. You'll see there that, as I have on the right there, the total index filter factor is actually 0.0043. Now, how did we arrive at that? Well, there are 26 possible values for city and 9 possible values for state. So if I take 1 over 26 and multiply it by 1 over 9, I get 0.0043. And what that's telling me is that I've multiplied the two filter factors together, obviously. But based on our counts earlier, we found that state and city were correlated. Once we knew the city, it didn't provide any value to know the state. So why did the optimizer multiply those two filter factors together? The answer is that the optimizer will always consider the predicates independent unless we have statistics that indicate otherwise. So obviously there are no correlation statistics out there which tell us not to multiply those two filter factors together. From slide 43, I show you a way to detect whether correlation exists. And we do actually document this technique in the administration guide. Quite simply, you run a count of the count distinct of the two columns in question in this case. Count distinct city, count distinct state. I get 26 cities and 9 states. Now, you could have just looked up the column cardinality in the catalog for these two columns, and that should show you 26 and 9, provided the statistics are up to date. Or this count is another way of doing that. The next count provides you a count of the number of distinct occurrences for the group of those two columns. So you see I have a select distinct city and state in a nested table expression, and I'm selecting a count from that. And we find that there are 31 combinations of city and state. On slide 44, here's the calculation to figure out whether those columns are correlated or not. If I multiply the two counts together, 26 and 9, I get 234. The group count that I got from running that second count on the previous slide was 31. Now, if the product of the counts is greater than the group count, so if 234 is greater than 31, then the columns are correlated. Because 234 would be the number of combinations of city and state I would get if every city belonged in every state. Now, how did the optimizer arrive at the current index qualified row estimate? Remember we said 825 rows qualified from that index. Well, if you take 192,000 multiplied by 1 over 26 multiplied by 1 over 9, you get 824.6. Now, as I've already mentioned, the statistics currently fail to show that the columns are correlated. So a bit more in the theory in 45, slide 45 here. On a scale of 100% correlated to 100% independent, if these two columns, city and state, were 100% correlated, then each city would only exist in one state. So the group count for those would equal 26. It would equal the highest, be the same as the highest column cardinality of one of the individual columns. But if they are 100% independent, then it would equal the product of the two, which is 234. So the counts show that there are 31 combinations of city and state. So some cities exist in more than one state, but not every city exists in every state. On slide 46, let's look at the available statistics that the optimizer has. And what the optimizer will use is it uses its available multi-column cardinalities, which we call M cards, often referred to also as key cards. So it could come from the index key card, it could come from index full key cards, or it could come from call groups that have been collected from other columns. The available cardinalities for city and state, we have an index on CustIX4 that includes both city and state in the index. Now, the only statistic we've collected as a multi-column cardinality for this index is full key card. And the full key card for this index, which is the multi-column cardinality of all the columns in the index, is 192,960, which is the number of rows in the table, and that's because the account number column is unique. Now, I've put this in the index, obviously, for a purpose, to demonstrate this example. Now, what about on slide 47? What if I had collected key cards? By default, RunStats collects the first key card and full key card. Key card is an option of RunStats. It will collect the intermediate cardinalities. So, in this example, we only get first key card and full key card. If I specify key card in my RunStats, I'll also get the second key card. The full column index, you'll get second key card and third key card. Okay? Traditional RunStats is already giving you the first key card and the full key card. Now, how relevant is key card for this example? Well, it's actually not relevant because we need statistics that include, we need multi-column cardinalities that include the two columns that are important to the object, which is city and state. So key card includes city and account number. We need city and state. So in this example, key card would not be relevant. On slide 48, so the effect of the screening predicate here is that when I do collect full key card or I do collect key card, the full key card here is unique because account number is unique. Now, that's the only multi-column cardinality that the optimizer has. When the optimizer is figuring out the filtering for the object, remember it takes the two where clause predicates, the filter factors, and multiplies them together. Then we look at the available multi-column cardinalities and we say, do the statistics show that these two columns are correlated or not? Remember, the full key card we have is 192,960. Now, when I multiply 26 and I multiply it with 9, I get 234. Now, 234 is significantly less than the full key card. So what that means is this statistic is telling me that these two columns are not correlated. And purely that is because I have a very high cardinality column as the second column. So it has destroyed the full key card or the correlation statistic that I have available to me. On slide 49, this is the statistic we need. We need a multi-column cardinality that just has city and state. Now, in version 8, it's quite simple to collect this for non-indexed columns or non-consecutive key columns. Had I had an index in version 7 or in version 8 that had city and state as the first two columns in either order, I would have already collected this multi-column cardinality. But because I do not, I'm not collecting this statistic. So using the new call group keyword, I can quite easily collect the column group multi-column cardinality for city and state. And you'll see on slide 50, now that I've collected that statistic, you'll see that the optimizer is now choosing the correct index on zip code. On slide 51, now we show you the index scan detail for the new index choice, which is CustIX5. The optimizer is estimating here that 3,711 rows qualify. And the reason I'm showing you this will be evident on the next slide. So the optimizer thinks 3,700 rows qualifies in this index. On slide 52, we show the fetch detail. So this is on the data side, and we're applying then two stage one predicates. So from the index, 3,711 rows qualify, so that's how many rows survive to the data side. Then we apply those two where clause predicates. The optimizer then says that the total number of returned rows is 119.7. Now, how did the optimizer figure that out? Well, if we look at the two individual filter factors, 3,711 multiplied by 1 over 26 multiplied by 1 over 9 actually equals 16. So the optimizer didn't believe that these two columns of city and state are independent because we did provide now a correlation statistic. So instead of thinking 16 rows, it thinks 119. But didn't we already determine that once you know the zip code, adding city and state doesn't provide any further filtering? But why doesn't the optimizer know this? The reason is because we've collected correlation statistics on city and state, but now the optimizer thinks that they're independent from zip code. Now, on slide 53, just to prove the whole correlation equation again, I run a count distinct of the three columns. I get my three counts, 26, 9, and 52. I do a count on the bottom of the screen there of the three columns, the distinct combinations of the three columns, and I get 52. There are 52 combinations of city, state, and zip code. On 54, you'll see that if I run the product of the counts, 26 by 9 by 52, I get 12,000. The group count is 52. If 12,000 is greater than 52, so if the product is greater than the group count, which it is, these columns are correlated. Now, collecting the col group for those three columns will provide that information to the optimizer that these three columns are actually correlated. And on slide 55, you'll see now that the data fetch result, this is not going to change the index choice. What it changes here is the number of rows that the optimizer estimates qualify from this table. So the input cardinality from the index is 3,711. After applying those two where clause predicates, the optimizer thinks 3,710.769 rows qualify. Now why is it dropped under 3,711? Let's chalk that up to a rounding error. But it's close enough because it'll round it up to say, well, we can't have a fraction of a row anyway, so 3,711 rows qualify. So basically now we know that city and state provide no additional benefit. Now why did I bother with the additional correlation statistics for zip code, city and state? Well, for this query there was no benefit. But let's think, if this was a multi-table join, so there were five tables in the query, or there was a sort required, and the optimizer had a choice between sorting and not sorting. If the optimizer thinks 119 rows qualify from this query, from this table, I'm sorry, then that's how many rows it thinks it has to sort, or how many rows it has to join to the second table and the third table, etc. But if the reality is that these columns are correlated and it's really 3,700 rows, then I would rather the optimizer knew that, because that may then go into the optimizer's choice as to whether to choose an access path that requires a sort or avoids a sort. It may influence the table join sequence or the index choices that are chosen for subsequent tables. Because I can tell you that it is more expensive for the for DB2 to sort 3,700 rows than it is 119 rows. So knowing that information may influence the optimizer to maybe avoid a sort because it doesn't want to sort 3,700 rows where it may have chosen to sort the 119 rows. So on slide 56, some conclusions about correlation. As I mentioned earlier, the optimizer considers columns to be independent unless statistics demonstrate otherwise. Now, this can have a dramatic effect on the total estimate for the object, either the index or the table, because the filter factors get potentially multiplied together. Now, correlation does not require knowledge of literal values. Indexes can provide correlation information, preferably indexes should be designed for filtering. Run stats should be used for correlation where possible. On slide 57, some recommendations. Use key card option for all multi-column indexes because that second key card, third key card, etc., is very beneficial for the optimizer to use the available M card when you are matching on less than the full key card of the index. Create indexes to support filtering and use the Colgrove option to collect correlation for matching plus screening cases to give us a better estimate for that index and for total predicate filtering to figure out how many rows qualify from the table. Now, the reason you're not seeing this as a disaster everywhere, because as you've seen that we can, the optimizer can easily overestimate the filtering on the index or on the table, is because indexes are providing that statistic for you today. So accidentally, without you knowing, you're getting those correlation statistics based on available indexes. So it only pops up when you have matching plus screening cases, and then you have multiple indexes to choose from, or you have multiple predicates that aren't indexed, and then you're joining multiple tables. So on slide 58, the next topic we're going to cover is range predicate accuracy. And again, slide 59, similar example that we've had before using the customer table. I've got three where clause predicates, two equals and a less than. The optimizer is choosing a multi-index access plan here. Now, obviously, this is not the optimal plan because the user is complaining about the performance. On slide 60, first you want to start by determining where the problem is. Same process we've used for the two prior examples. Use some values that are problematic, and here the count returns 1,536 rows for those three sets of data values. Again, on slide 61, we're going to match it to the available indexes. I've got an index on zip code, and I've also got an index on city and birthday. So should I choose CustIX 5 or CustIX 6? They're the available choices for the optimizer. And of course, I haven't really covered it. Table space scan is a viable option for the optimizer, but these examples were assuming that the index is preferred. On 62, I'm running counts per index, per object. The first index, CustIX 5, qualifies 1,536 rows, which is actually the total number of rows qualified for the entire query. The second index qualifies 7,968. So given that the first index itself provides all the filtering, why is the optimizer deciding to use multi-index access from both of those indexes? On slide 63, we break it down further to individual where clause predicates. And you'll see here that the striking or alarming count is that the where birth date less than 9991231 qualifies all the rows in the table. So on slide 64, let's see what the optimizer thinks these filter factors are. City, there's 26 possible values. Remember, we're using host variables or literal host variables or parameter markers. So the optimizer thinks that 126 is the filter factor. Zip code, there are 52 possible values, so the optimizer thinks 1.92. Birth date, the optimizer thinks 0.1 is the filter factor. On 65, when we compare that to the reality, remember we have the count, we take the count divided by the table cardinality, and in column 4, we get the actual filter factor, and we compare that to the optimizer's filter factor in column 5. So City of Atlanta, the actual is 4%, the optimizer thinks 3.8%. That's at least in the ballpark. Zip code, optimizer thinks 1.92%, the actual is 0.8%. It's sort of in the ballpark, but it's not accurate. And we know that city and zip code are skewed and correlated, and we have that information already, but we can't take advantage of the skew in this case because we're using post variable. But the alarming filter factor here is that the actual for birth date is 1 or 100% of the rows qualifying, and the optimizer thinks 0.1 or 10%. So to me, that's the most problematic filter factor in this estimate versus the actual. So why is that incorrect? Well, how did the optimizer come up with that 0.1 or 10%? If you look on slide 66, this is actually what we document in the administration guide. When you're using host variables or parameter markers, these are the filter factors that the optimizer will use for range predicates. So when the column cardinality that I've circled there is greater than or equal to 100, but less than 1,000, the filter factor that it will use for less than or equal to, greater than or equal to, is 1 over 10. So that's the filter factor that the optimizer came up with for birthday. Now, this is DB2's documented guess. It's very difficult to estimate correctly. So on 67, slide 67, I try and explain to you why it's difficult to estimate. So let me give you an example here. Birth date less than or equal to host variable. How many people on the call, I know you can't answer me, but how many people on the call were born before host variable? Now, if I specify the value of 1920-0101, maybe none of us on the call were born before 1920. Okay? So that's 0% of the rows qualify. But if I put in that host variable 1990-0101, I'm expecting that all of us were born before 1990. Okay? So how does the optimizer come up with a filter factor that is always correct when you could specify that 0% of the rows qualify all the way through to 100% of the rows qualify? The answer is that it cannot come up with one single estimate that is always correct for a host variable or a parameter marker. So once we know the literal value, the optimizer can go through its estimation process and compare it to the high 2-key and low 2-key values that are stored, which on slide 68 we've done. So once we've provided the literal values with either reopt always or hard-coded, the optimizer is now choosing simply the index on zip code. Now, on slide 69, we see the predicate report with literals. You'll see there that once I provide the literal values, for the city predicate, I'm getting an exact filter factor again. Why? Because I've already, in the previous examples, the first example, I've collected data skew information for city. In neither of the example have I actually collected data skew information for zip code, so zip code is still a slightly incorrect estimate, but we don't care at the moment because we're choosing the right index. Birth date, the optimizer's estimate now is 99.78%. That's near enough to 100%. Considering that previously we were thinking 10% of the rows qualify. So when I look on slide 70 at the Statistics Advisor recommendations, you'll see here that in the explanation, the Statistics Advisor tool has recommended that firstly we recommend reopt hours or reopt once because we have host variables, parameter markers, or special registers for all three of those where clause predicates. So on slide 71, some conclusions about range predicates with parameter markers or host variables. The optimizer has this documented best guess. It's in the admin guide. It's impossible for the optimizer to always estimate correctly, just as I tried to provide you an example. Now, we also use this for special registers with birth date less than current date. Now, the defaults are very optimistic. So for the optimizer to think 10% of the rows qualify, as I said, that's quite optimistic, especially when the actual value you specify is pessimistic. It's the reverse. So if you know that we think 10% are going to qualify and it's really more like 70, 80, 90, or 100%, then that optimizer estimate is going to be very poor. Slide 72, some possible recommendations. Reopt always or reopt bars is an obvious choice here. It provides the literal value for the optimizer. Now, an alternative, of course, is that you actually provide the literal value if you always search with that value. For dynamic SQL, reopt once is an option. So we will use the estimate based on the first execution, the literal value that you provide for the first execution. Another recommendation is don't index range predicate columns that are poorly filtering. If you know something's going to be challenging for the optimizer and the optimizer's going to get it wrong, don't be surprised if you throw that challenge to the optimizer and it gets it wrong. If you can't provide the literal value or you don't want to use reopt, then if that predicate is not really filtering, you know the optimizer is going to get it wrong. And we document that. Now, what that means is that the poorly estimated predicates can actually encourage an index to be chosen. So, theoretically, you could use that in your favor. If it has to be indexed, then put it in the good index and the bad index. So at least you level the playing field. On slide 73, we list some other predicate challenges for the optimizer. Column expression, where substring state 1, 1 equal to A. And the optimizer has difficulty with estimating those column expressions correctly. Now, you might have a column expression that says where salary plus bonus is less than 10,000. Those sort of things are very difficult for the optimizer to estimate correctly. Non-column expressions also, where the expression does not include a column. So a calculation, and you'll see that where birth date less than date 2006-0101 minus 1 year, while that's an indexable predicate, stage one and indexable, the optimizer may not estimate correctly even though we've provided the literal value there. Like predicate, this one is a very difficult one to estimate. Where last name like percent A percent, basically what I'm asking you for is how many people in the phone book have an A in their last name somewhere. That is a very difficult thing for the optimizer to estimate. And the fourth example, in predicates with many duplicates. It's common for people to, there might be 20 host variables or 20 parameter markers listed there. So the optimizer thinks you're going to populate those with 20 values. Now, sometimes you see people putting in two values and then they duplicate the second value the last 18 times. And so there's really only two values, but you've told the optimizer that there is actually 20 values. So in conclusion, on slide 74, then slide 75, what I've tried to demonstrate is the two main factors for the optimizer to accurately cost each object. Firstly, it's the individual filter factors. And secondly, it's how those filter factors are combined. Now, these impact estimates for index matching, total index filtering, total table level filtering. And we've tried to highlight how DB2 version 8 simplifies the process of identifying and resolving the poor optimizer estimate. So identification, when you run these counts, which is a process you could have done in version 7 and so forth. But now with the Visual Explain tool, you have the ability to compare your estimates, your actual, with the optimizer's estimates. We now provide that filter factor information and the optimizer's estimates to you, which we haven't done in the past. And also version 8 simplifies the resolution with the new runstat syntax by allowing you to use the col group keyword to collect correlation and also to collect skew statistics. So to slide 76, that is all I have for you. Thank you very much for listening. I will hand it back to our moderator or the operator for any questions. Thank you for listening.
And at this time, if you do have a question or comment, it's star 1 on your touchtone phones. Pressing star 1 will place your line into a queue, and your lines will be opened. You'll be invited to direct your question to Mr. Purcell. Again, that's star and 1 if you do have a question. And we'll take a question from William Furman with UBS.
Yes, if we use the call group, and we don't want to do this, say, every time we do a run stats, will the call group information be destroyed if we do not execute it on a subsequent run stats?
So the question is, if you collect these special call group statistics, will a separate run stats job overwrite them? And the answer is no, they will not. Unless you specify complementary statistics. So if I have collected the individual frequencies for the gender column, until I have another run stats that collects the gender statistics again, I will not overwrite those statistics. That makes sense? So if I collect a special statistic, but my weekly run stats does not include that statistic, or it doesn't have an index out there with that as the leading column, so it's collecting those by default, then no, they won't be destroyed or overwritten by your separate run stats job.
Anything further, Mr. Furman?
So that's a good and a bad thing if I just take
that.
No,
that's fine.
Okay. So if I just take that a little further while we're waiting for the next question, that can be a good and a bad thing. What that means is, in my examples with data skew, these frequency statistics, they scale. If status was always 95% yes and 5% no, if it's that way when I've got 100,000 rows in the table and it's still that way when I have 10 million rows in the table, I actually only need to collect it once and never collect it again, theoretically. But also that means is that if the data does change and I haven't recollected, then I can have stale statistics out there. So it's a double-edged sword. It can be good. If your data doesn't change, you can collect it once. But bad if you collect it once and then your data does change and you haven't recollected.
And next we'll take a question from Daniel Deshong with AES.
Hi, Terry. This is actually Mark Levy.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Hi. Hey, I just have a follow-up question on something I think we had discussed earlier. Do you know if anyone actually submitted a request for the reopt once to apply to the static SQL?
So the question is, did we get a request for reopt once for static SQL? And the answer is not in time for it to make it into version 9 or DB2.9. We do have some requests from customers now for improvements to reopt in DB2 version next. So, and it's your guess, what is the number after 9? I cannot speculate.
Okay, thanks.
Next we'll go to Konstantin Tadenev with UPS.
Hello, Terry. A quick question on GTTs. Can you explain in general what rules are applied to GTTs when they participate in joins?
So when we talk about global temporary tables, there are two types. We have the declared global temporary tables and we have the created global temporary tables. I'm assuming from your example you're talking about the created. But I can quickly cover both.
That's correct.
With the created global temporary tables, with static SQL, during the bind process, we use what available catalog statistics there are. And if you haven't collected any statistics on your global temporary table, which, of course, is very difficult to run stats against a global temporary table, so if there are no statistics being collected, then we just assume the defaults, which is minus one of the number of rows in the table, which is assuming then our estimate then is 10,000 rows qualify. For the individual columns, the column cardinalities we assume to be 25. That's when no statistics have been collected. So what that means, any where clause predicates against your global temporary tables, we'll assume, if it's an equals, we'll assume 1/25th of 10,000 rows qualify. And you do have the option for to update the catalog to provide a more representative value. Say you have, for example, 10 rows in the table that generally get populated, then you can update the table cardinality to 10. And also you can update the column cardinalities to be more representative of, you know, say you have a gender column in your global temporary table, instead of us estimating 1/25, maybe you want us to estimate 1/2. So basically, default statistics are used unless you update the catalog yourself. The declared global temporary tables are different. They're the ones that are sort of created on the fly. and the optimizer does track how many rows are inserted into the declared global temporary table. And then when you actually execute the query, we use that information of how many rows were inserted into the declared global temporary table. So that requires a sort of mini rebind of the query when we execute it.
Very interesting.
So hopefully that's answered your question, Constantine.
Yes, thank you, Terry.
And next we'll go to Mano Mathai with ATPCO.
I have a question on page 73 regarding the difficult predicate examples. In the in predicate with duplicates, is it better to use in predicate with duplicates or use a join using a created global temp table?
So the question is it better to use, a long in list where there may be duplicates or to use a created global temporary table?
That's correct.
And you know that I'm going to give you the typical DBA answer, which says it depends, because, you know, we know with query performance often there is no one straight answer. But generally, I would say that it's better to use the in list rather than the... And I would say that generally. I'm not saying that that is always the case. The reason is because it is more efficient to simply use the in-list. The optimizer at execution time will sort and remove the duplicates. The problem is, of course, when the optimizer estimated, we thought that there were 20 rows and 20 values and there were really only two. But at execution time, we see the two because we've sorted and removed duplicates, provided we're using that for matching in-list access. The created global temporary table requires, of course, you to do the inserts into the temporary table, and then we have to do the process of a join. So that is more expensive. So provided we choose the right access path with the in-list, then that is the preferred method instead of the temporary table. The challenge is, what if we didn't choose the right access path? And that is probably where I think people have used that approach with the created temporary table, because when you get a very large number of in-list elements, one of the challenges with in-lists, if it's a poorly clustering index that we're matching on, in-lists do not actually support list prefetch at this point. So if you have a lot of random IOs, you might have an in-list of 200 values. The optimizer will have to do a significant number of random IOs. So if you have an in-list of 200 values and you really only put two values in there, that is going to significantly affect the optimizer's estimate as far as how many random IOs it thinks it has to do. But joins, of course, can use list prefetch, and there are other join methods available. Hopefully that gave you some logic behind the it depends answer.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Mr. Purcell, that's all the questions that we have. I'll turn it back to you, sir, for any closing or additional remarks.
Nothing else from me. I just wanted to say thank you. My email address is on the last slide. I'm hoping I don't get 200 emails after today's call, but obviously my email address is there, and if you have any further questions, please contact me. Thank you for your attendance.
This does conclude today's teleconference, and we thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect your lines and have a great day.